this parashat revolves really around one theme. It's such an interesting parashah because it really revolves around only one idea. So we start out with the death of Sarah Imenu, and the first thing that Avraham Avinu needs to do, that he's confronted with when Sarah dies, is what's the first concern? What's the issue? What? Burial. Well, what's the problem with burial? There's plenty of dirt. There's plenty of land. So what's the issue? Why does he have a problem with burial? He lives there. He should just go and dig a hole in the ground and bury his wife. Why is it such a significant issue that he needs to purchase a burial ground for his wife? Why is that so important? What's the significance of it? I mean, what's the difference? A person passes away and we place their remains in the ground out of respect, but what difference does it really make, you know, whether it's owned by Avraham Avinu or it's owned by somebody else? So you see, this is a very big deal to Avraham because he goes to the people of Canaan, the Bnei Chet. Okay, this is on page 106. He goes to Bnei Chet. And he says to them, after the funeral, he says to them, "Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. I'm just a stranger. Right? I'm just a stranger here. I'm just visiting here. I don't really live here." Why is he saying that? Doesn't Avraham live in... What age was Avraham when he moved here? What age was he? 75 years old. And now he's already, you know, well past into his hundreds. You know, when Sarah Imenu dies, she's 127. He's 10 years older than her. Okay, so that means he's 137 years old. So he's lived there for, 60 years, right? Almost 60 years, almost. I'm not a math teacher. Oh, 27, not 23. Right, you're right, sorry, 62 years. Absolutely right, see? Yeah, so, no, you're right. I was thinking 123 in my mind for some reason. You're right. So it was over 60 years, 62 years. So now that he's there for 62 years, I mean, how much of a guest could you be? 62 years is a long time. And yet he says to them, I'm just a guest here. Tenuli achuzat kever imachem. Please give me achuzat kever. Achuzat kever means, le'echoz means something I can grab. Meaning I want to possess a burial ground. I don't want you to give me a burial plot in your cemetery. I want my own area. And what do they say to him? My master, listen. You are a prince of God. You are a celebrity around here. You are somebody very important. Everybody respected and admired Avraham. For the past 60 plus years, he's been becoming more and more famous. He's out there preaching his monotheism. He's fought wars against kings. He's been involved with the dignitaries and with the most significant personalities of the time. He's not a nobody. He's a somebody. Okay, so when they hear that he needs a burial plot, they say, "What do you mean? Please give me a burial plot." No problem. You should be able to bury in whatever burial plot you want. You're amongst us. Right? They said to him, "Nesi Elohim ata bitochenu. You are amongst us. You're one of us. What do you mean? I'm only a stranger." You're not a stranger. You're part of the community. We love you. We admire you. We put you on a pedestal. Anybody will give you their burial plot. Do you need a grave to bury your wife? Anybody will give you. But that's not good for Avraham. He doesn't want that. He says no. He says, "Vayakom Avraham vayishtachu amarz v'nechet." Says that's not good. He says, if you really want to help me, you have to talk to Ephron ben Sochar, and I need the cave that he has, Marata Machpelah. I need to have Marata Machpelah. I want to have it. And so, of course, they call Ephron. Ephron comes, and he says, "I'm willing to pay full price. I don't want a discount. Pay full price." Ephron comes, and Ephron is?
Persian.
He's Persian for sure. Right? He's definitely Persian. Because he does tarof. It's the first tarof in the Torah. Because what does Ephron say? "No, take it for free. You don't have to pay anything. It's no problem. It's on me. We're friends." And Avraham insists on paying. And so Ephron does a little bit of a fast one on Avraham. So not only does he first kind of flatter him and say, no, you can have it for free. But he says, you know what? Not only can you have the cave, I'm going to throw in the entire field. Who wants a field that somebody else owns the cave in the middle of it? Right? So he's willing, he wants to sell him a bigger piece of real estate. He doesn't want to sell him only the cave. So he says, no, take the cave and even take the field. For free, of course. He says, because what's a 400 shekel piece of property between friends like us? So he makes sure to mention the price, you know, in the discussion. And so Abraham hears the deal and he pays for it. But the question is, why is it so important to Abraham to have this burial ground for Sarah? Why can't he just use one of the burial plots of one of the people of Chet that they're perfectly willing to give him a burial plot in their cemetery? Why does he have to pick a cave? What's the reason? Well, that's true. So one element of Abraham that you have to look at is that Abraham has lived in Canaan for over 60 years and he doesn't own one inch of the land in Canaan. Hashem told him, your descendants are going to have this land. He doesn't possess anything in Canaan. He is a wanderer. He is a nomad in Canaan. He's never purchased one inch of ground in Canaan. So this is the first time he is purchasing a piece of Israel. Okay? And as I mentioned in our Mincha Shior, there are three pieces of property that the Tanakh records that we paid for, that the Jewish people paid for out of their own pocket. One is this, Marat HaMachpelah. The other one is when Yaakov Avinu comes back from living with Lavan, okay, he comes to Shechem and he purchases that and it tells us the price. David HaMelech purchases Har HaBayit, he purchases the Temple Mount from Aravna HaYivusi, in Sefer Shemuel, towards the end of Sefer Shemuel, he purchases the plot that is going to eventually become Har HaBayit. It's going to become the location of the Beit HaMikdash. And all three of these places, it says the exact amount of money that was paid for the property, for the real estate. It records exactly how much was paid, that was paid in full, that they insisted on paying in full. And all three of those places have something very interesting in common. They're all owned by Arabs today. Right? Every single one of them is controlled by Arabs. Hebron is an Arab village, Shechem is Arabs, Har HaBayit is controlled by Arabs, we're not even allowed to go up there, or if we do, we cause intifadas to happen, apparently. So it is a fascinating kind of irony that the places in Israel that we actually paid for, we didn't take them by military might, but we actually paid for them fair and square with money, these are the places that we don't have today. They belong to other people, they belong to the Arabs. But in any case, be that as it may, so it's very important to Abraham to have this as a separate and distinct place. One of the reasons is because he wants to have a footing in the land of Israel. He finally owns a piece of the land of Israel. He can point to it and say, I own part of this land. And he doesn't just want to own something on his own. He owns something that he's going to share in a way with Sarah. Because she's going to be laid to rest there and he's going to be laid to rest there. But there's another aspect to it, which is that Avraham Avinu, when his wife dies, what is his concern now? What is the concern now? What's number one on the priority list of Avraham?
After Sarah, Yitzchak.
After she dies, well, what he works on immediately is finding a wife for Yitzchak, right? Right. That's what he works on immediately. But the question is, why is that the first... All these years, what kind of a Jewish mother was Sarah? She didn't care about her son getting married. You know, normally that's all they obsess about all the time is the son getting married. She doesn't obsess over it. And then as soon as she dies, now all of a sudden Abraham is concerned with finding a wife for Yitzchak. Why? Okay, definitely. So one aspect that he realizes how important it is, but why did he wait till now? He must have known it before. Why is it so critical now? Okay, so they need a matriarch, right? They have no matriarch in the family. In other words, when Sarah dies, that means the baton is being passed to the next generation. Okay? The leadership is being passed to the next generation. And in order to be a patriarch, Yitzchak has to be married. How is he going to be able to be the head of a family and continue the lineage of Abraham without having a family? He has to have a wife. He has to be complete. So Avram, when Sarah dies, realizes it's time for me to go into retirement now. Even though he still has another number of years left on his life, like almost 40 years left of his life. But he says, you know what? As soon as Sarah is gone, that means that I'm retired, and now I have to focus on the next generation. In other words, this is about transitions. And so there's two things you need to worry about in transitions. One is the future, obviously. You have to worry about Yitzchak finding a wife and building a family. But you also have to worry about how are future generations going to stay connected to their heritage? How are they going to stay connected to their heritage? And one of the ways we do that, sadly, is through cemeteries. Because when we have a separate Jewish cemetery that's identifiable, that our ancestors were special people. They weren't just ordinary people, but they were people that had a very unique set of values, unique view of the world, unique tradition that they were starting, in this case, you know, with Sarah and Avraham. They were not just run-of-the-mill people. If you bury them next to everyone else, the implication is that ultimately, they were just like everybody else. By keeping them separate, both when they're alive and when they pass away, you're saying we're separate. Where our identity is distinct. Avraham wants to make sure that the sense that we are different is carried on. And so there are two ways that we do this. One is Brit Milah, obviously. Brit Milah is at the beginning of life. And the other one is at the end of life. When a person's buried, they're buried in a place which is distinct. It's very rare for a Jew to be buried in a Christian cemetery. And certainly not for a Christian to be buried in a Jewish cemetery. Religions generally keep their buried, you know, their deceased separate from other religions. It's not just a Jewish concept. But I think it started with Judaism. The idea that our identity is not just in life, but also in death. That we're distinct. And so, Avram understood that, and he wanted to demonstrate that, not just for himself, but for future generations. So that the future generations would have Marat HaMachpelah to identify with, to connect to our ancestors, and to have that bond with them, that link with them, that they're special people, they're unique people, they're not just ordinary people. And so that was why it was so important. So Avraham is concerned with legacy, we could say. What they say is legacy building, right? That's what they talk about presidents in their lame duck term, you know, like now. That they're worried about their legacy. You know, they start trying to worry about how are future generations going to view me? What ranking am I going to be on the list of presidents, you know, best or worst or whatever? Am I going to be... His only question is, am I going to be even worse than Jimmy Carter or just as bad? You know, he's not sure. He's trying to figure that out. So these are important calculations for the president, you know, when he's leaving office, because he's going to pass on whatever he gives over to the next generation or the next administration to handle. So that's what Avraham Avinu in his own way is thinking about. How am I going to pass on these ideas to the next generation? I have to make sure that Yitzchak has a family, a wife, children, so that he's able to continue this. And I need to make sure that he doesn't forget his past. He doesn't forget where he came from. He doesn't forget that we're unique and we're different. Okay? Not only in this world, also in the next world, we're different. Okay? Kol Yisrael yesh lam chelek la'olam haba. We also have a different destination after this world. So Avraham wants to emphasize that to the future generation. And it wouldn't be enough. It would dilute the message if Sarai Menu is buried in some, you know, next to some idolater, some pagan, you know, right next to that idolater is the Sarai Menu and Avraham Avinu. It would blur the distinction that needs to be made. And his whole life, Avraham was separate, right? Everything is about separation in Avraham. He separates from his family. He separates from Lot. He separates from Ishmael. He separates even from Yitzchak, although he doesn't ultimately have to separate from him. He doesn't have to kill him. But everything in his life is about separation. It's about being distinct. It's about staying out of what everybody else is doing. He stays out of politics. He stays out of military conflicts. He doesn't try to compete with people. He doesn't try to get involved with whatever the dramas of the day are. He stays apart. And so even in death, he says we have to stay apart. We remain singular. And so that's part of his building of a legacy is establishing how the past is going to be viewed. And part of building a legacy is making sure that there's somebody to pass the torch to in the future. And that's going to be Yitzchak. And that brings us, of course, to the next story, which is about Yitzchak. Now, you might know that the Haftarah for this parasha is about David HaMelech on his deathbed, right? Now, David HaMelech on his deathbed is also concerned with similar issues as Avraham Avinu. Because David HaMelech is a first. He's also a first. He's the first in a line of monarchs that's going to pass on the tradition to the future of monarchy. And this is on page 1136. And we find that V'HaMelech David Zaken ba bayamim, ba'yichaseu ba'begadim. So he became in his old age very cold and he wasn't able to warm up, And so they covered him with blankets and it didn't work. So they bring him this young woman who keeps him warm at night and all that. Anyway, they didn't. It wasn't a relationship that went beyond warming one another. And part of the reason why it mentions it is 1136, because later on in the story, this Avishaga Shunamit, who is the warming lady, ends up playing a role in a drama that happens later between Shlomo and one of his brothers. But for now, the point of the story is that David is very old. He kind of becomes, he takes a back seat. You know, when a king gets very old, he kind of recedes from daily affairs. And what happens is that one of the sons of David, okay, Adoniyahu, decides, I'm going to be the next king. Now, who's supposed to be the king after David? Shlomo HaMelech. Now, everybody seems to know that except Adoniyahu. Or he does know it. He does know because he doesn't call Shlomo or any of the people who are the insiders, the cabinet of David. He calls everybody but them to this big party coronating himself. Okay? And so Adoniyahu tries to grab the kingdom. And so Natan HaNavi does something really interesting. Natan HaNavi does something that it took me a long time to understand the logic of what he did. He goes in to speak to Bathsheba. Who is Bathsheba? The wife of David and also the mother of Shlomo. She goes and speaks to him and says, you know, I don't know if you know what's going on, but Adoniyahu is declaring himself the king. And he says, listen, you're going to be in big trouble if this works out because if Adoniyahu wins, then he's going to obviously want to eliminate whoever the competition is, right? You're going to be in big trouble. He says, listen, I got advice for you. Go into David HaMelech and say to him, didn't you promise me that Shlomo was going to be the king? What happened? And as soon as you say that, I'm going to walk in and back you up and say, Adoniyahu is declaring himself as the king. You need to do something. So I always wonder, and that's what happens. So she goes in and she says to the king, you know, didn't you promise me that Shlomo was going to be the king and now Adoniyahu is becoming the king? What's going on here? And then all of a sudden Natan walks in. Natan HaNavi walks in and bows down and he says, oh, have you said that Adoniyahu is going to be the king? Because I see that he's having a big party declaring himself as the king. Right? And you've never told me who's going to be the successor. And of course Bathsheba is there. And so David says no, and he makes a big deal out of declaring Shlomo the king and stopping this rebellion of Adoniyahu. But I always wondered, why couldn't Natan HaNavi just walk into David's office, you know, whatever it is, his chamber, and say, David, you know, what's going on with this Adoniyahu guy? Why is he declaring himself the king? Why doesn't he just go and directly ask David? Why does he have to make this thing that he goes and tells Bathsheba? Bathsheba, you go in and say, you know, didn't you say that Shlomo was going to be the king after you and what's going on? And then I'll come in and back you up. Why do you need both of those things? Why can't you just have one? Why can't Natan HaNavi just walk right into David HaMelech and say, hello, what's going on? Adoniyahu is declaring himself the king. Or have Bathsheba walk in and that should do the trick. Why do you need them both to walk in to make the point? So I think that the answer is like this, that if Bathsheba comes in and says, oh, you know, David, you promised that Shlomo is going to be the king, and I see Adoniyahu is going to become the king. What, it's very possible for David to be like, don't worry about it. You know, he's already old. Ah, don't worry about it. You know, we'll take care of it. Everything will work out. There's no reason to worry. There's no reason to get too excited. You know, I'm sure everything will be fine, you know, one way or another. So the way that Natan orchestrates it is, at the very moment that Bathsheba is saying to David, didn't you promise me Shlomo's going to be the king? Natan walks in and says, we need an answer right now. Who's going to be the king? So David can't give a wishy-washy answer to Bathsheba. He can't say, oh, don't worry, we'll work it out, you know. Because he's older, he doesn't want to get involved in drama right now. So Bathsheba's role is that she walks in to bring up the issue that you promised that Shlomo is going to be the king. Natan's job is that he comes in and says, you need to make the decision right now. Don't tell me, well, we'll talk about it, we'll have 17 meetings, you know, we'll have this committee meet, and then the other committee will meet, and then another group will meet, and then we'll come together and we'll figure it out. No, we need to know immediately, because Adoniyahu is declaring that he's the king. You got access, so who is it? Because he had never told Natan that it was going to be Shlomo directly, so he said, I don't know, who is it going to be? You need to tell me right now. So to Natan, he could have said, okay, if Adoniyahu wants to be the king, fine, let him have it, you know, no big deal. If Bathsheba came in, he might have said, oh, don't worry, we'll take care of it. We'll have seven committees on it by tomorrow. I'll tell them to take care of it. You know, meanwhile, Adoniyahu takes over. So that's why it had to be done this way. Bathsheba brings up the promise he made. Natan says we need an answer right now. Okay? Now, what is the connection of this to our Torah? You're going to say, well, I thought we were doing Parashah, not Haftarah. So what does this connect to? So it connects because the idea is that David had been a little bit remiss in making sure that his legacy was going to be transferred in the smoothest possible way. And Avraham, obviously, is really doing all the right things in terms of that. He realizes he's actually, when he's getting to his advanced age, he's already made sure that everything is in place. Okay, he's already set up Marat HaMachpelah. He's already getting Yitzchak set up to be the successor after him, making sure he has a wife, making sure everything's taken care of. So Avraham himself really was on the ball in terms of making sure that his legacy was going to be passed on to the next generation the proper way. David HaMelech needs to do that in the story, right? And so he's like pushed into doing it a little bit because David, one of the things that happens to David at the end of his life is he becomes very passive. And so he sometimes needs to be nudged a little bit. And that's what happens in the story. But the concept is the same. In both cases, we need to establish a successor as the pioneer. The first king is passing on. We need to know who's going to be the next king. The first Jew is passing on. Who's going to be the next Jewish household? So in both cases, you have the idea of succession, passing the torch from one generation to the next. That's the connection between the two, the Torah and the Haftarah. So it says Abraham becomes older, and of course he calls his servant to find a wife for Yitzchak. Right? There's so much in this parasha, we could actually do like four shiurim on this parasha. So it's like, I said to myself, what am I going to focus on when I come to the, I could probably give you 3 hours of on just this parasha. There's so much. So what I focus on is just random, because there's so much. So when Avraham instructs, by the way, it never mentions Eliezer's name. Okay, which is just important to realize. Never mentions his name. It always calls him Eved Avraham. It always calls him the servant of Avraham. It always calls him Ha'ish, the man. It never calls him Eliezer. By, you know, by inference, by tradition, we know it's Eliezer because it says that he called the person who was Zekan Beto HaMoshel B'chol HaShelot, the person who controlled everything in the household. We know that was Eliezer always. So we assume it's talking about him, but it never mentions his name, which is really interesting. Never mentions his name. I talked about that at the Mincha too. So maybe we'll touch on that. But let's first get into, because I explained why, but let's first get into a little bit what happened. So Avraham says to his servant, put your hand under my thigh, which is a way of swearing, and I'm going to make you swear by Hashem, God of the heaven and God of earth. This is page 110, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Kena'ani that I live amongst them. Asher anochi yoshe bekirbo. Ki mel arzi v'al molati telech. Go to my birthplace. V'lakachta isha livni liyitzchak. And I want you to take a wife for my son Yitzchak from there. Now, of course, the question that I always asked my teachers when I was a kid, and I thought it was really, you know, I thought it was a good question at the time. And then I found the Abarbanel asks this question. He asks, what difference is one idolater versus another idolater, right? You know, Abraham left his home. He left Ur Kasdim because everybody was idol worshipping, right? So why would he go back there to get a wife? What difference does it make if he takes an idol worshipper, a homegrown idol worshipper from Canaan, you know, a local girl, or he goes back to his family in Mesopotamia and takes a girl from there? They're both going to be worshipping idols. What's the difference? The whole reason why he left his home, nobody's heard from him for a long time. Because they know he left because he left the religion. He became a monotheist, right? What's the difference if he takes an idol worshiper from a local idol worshiper or he goes back there? It's a question that needs to be answered. So there's one, you can answer it in a spiritual way, you can answer it in a practical way. Ah, so that's a practical way. So that's what I was thinking, a practical way, exactly. A practical way of thinking of it is, if I marry Yitzchak to a girl who lives here, what's going to happen on Thanksgiving? We're going to have to go to the idolaters people's house, you know? In other words, I'm using that as anachronistic. Obviously, they didn't have Thanksgiving, but I'm saying they're right there. She's not going to be leaving her family, right? She's not going to, like you're saying, she's not going to be someone leaving something behind. She's going to not only not be leaving it, but they're going to be right there. They're going to want to come over for Sunday afternoon football games and to have barbecues at their house. They're going to be a part of their life. And Abraham wants someone who's going to be leaving behind their past and starting fresh. So it might very well be that the person from Mesopotamia, the girl from there, is also an idol worshiper. But if she's willing to leave behind what she has and start something new, that means that she isn't going to have roots where she is that are going to tie her to the old way. And it would be very difficult. It's like I always give the example of a person who's like, goes to jail or they go to rehab or something. And then they come back and they go right to the same neighborhood they were before. They see the same drug dealer that they had before, the same people that they used to mess around and do bad stuff with that they saw before. Like, they go right back into the same environment. In the same environment, when you're around the environment that was influencing you before, it's very hard to change. When you have to leave it behind and start fresh in a new place, it's easier to change. So that's a practical reason. The other reason that's possible is a spiritual reason, which is that even though Abraham broke away from what his family stood for, he obviously came from something. Okay? He obviously came from people who were of a high caliber. He didn't come from a low caliber of people. He came from the best that were around at that time. He was just the best of the best, so he had to leave. But he came from a background that obviously contributed in some way to the person he became. Even if he had to root out all the idolatrous elements to it. But it gave him a personality that made him open-minded enough and wise enough and ethical enough that he was able to be receptive to these new ideas. So we figured, if I go back to my old birthplace and take somebody from my family, who's the most likely going to be who's going to be receptive to what I have to teach and what I have to say? It's going to be somebody from my family because that's where I came from and I was receptive to it. So he wants to go back because he thinks that that's the best, that you know, these people who live in Canaan, they're idol worshippers too, but they're not as great as the family of Abraham was. Okay, look, Yaakov Avinu was able to go live with Laban. He couldn't have been that bad. He was bad, but he wasn't that bad. It was tolerable. So that's what Abraham is thinking, one of those two things, or both. And he says, don't go, so he says to him, go back to my family. And what does Eliezer, or the servant of Abraham, what does he argue? He says, maybe she won't want to come with me. How do I know she's going to want to leave her family and come? And he says, should I bring Yitzchak there? And what does Abraham say? Definitely not. Don't do that. Definitely don't do that. Whatever you do, do not bring my son back there. He says, because one thing that Hashem told me was, get out of there. And he will help you to find her, and you have to come back. But whatever you do, don't go back there. Don't bring Yitzchak back there. Meaning, if I don't survive to the end of this ordeal, don't think that you're going to bring Yitzchak back there. Okay? Now, when Eliezer goes, we know the whole story. He sees this girl. He asks her, can I have something to drink? She not only gives him the drink, she gives the camel the drink. He gives her jewelry. And then he goes back to her house. Then he asks, who are you? After he gives her jewelry. He says, who are you? And then she takes him back to her house to meet her family. Now, if you notice, it's very interesting. Take a look on page 114, and you will see what a difference there is between how Eliezer, this just shows you, you know, you don't have to always send a message the same. You have to cater your message to your audience. So look at how Eliezer explains what happened to him when he speaks to the people. So in verse 34, Vayomar, Eved Avraham Anochi, I am a servant of Abraham. Vashem, Berachet Adoni Meod Vayigdal. That my Hashem has blessed my master a lot and he's become great. He's given them all kinds of things, servant, money, servants, animals. And not only that, he has lots of wealth and he's bequeathed it all to the son. So what is he doing for the son? Making him a really good catch, right? He's a good shiduch. He's got a lot of money. Okay? Right. So, right, it has to be a good deal. If he says that it's a muttal the tailor, you know, she's not going to be running after. You know, I don't know if you ever saw The Fiddler on the Roof, but, you know, okay. It's not a Persian movie. It's a good movie. Vayashbieni Adoni Lemor. Now, pay attention. I want you to tell me, what does he say or not say that's different than what Avraham actually said to him? So he says, "Lo tigach yishalav nimi benot haKenani ashenochi yoshev be'aretzo." That my master said, he made me swear, don't take a woman for my son, from the daughters of the Kenani, ashenochi yoshev be'aretzo, that I live in his land, meaning that I live in the land of the Kenani. Don't take anybody local. Ki im lo el bet avi telech ve'el mishpachti ve'lakach ta'isha levni. You should go to the house of my father and my family, and you should take a wife for my son from there, right? Now, what does he say that's different here? Does anybody notice? There's two things that are different. Well, at least one thing in this part that's different. When Avram speaks to Eliezer versus this, take a look, and then we'll keep going and take a look at the differences. And then I said, "Va'omar el Adoni," I said to my master, "Ulai lo telecha isha acharai." Maybe she's not going to want to go with me. So what did Avraham actually say to Eliezer would happen if she didn't want to go with him? What did he actually ask Avraham?
So what should I do with that?
Should I bring Yitzchak back? And Avraham said, no way, absolutely not, over my dead body, don't do it. Right? Does Eliezer mention that part here? He forgets to mention that part. He says, I said to Avraham, maybe she won't want to go. And Avraham said to me, Vayomer Eli, Hashem asher talachti lefanav, yishlach malacho itach, v'itzach darkecha, v'lakach taisha levri, v'mishpachti v'beit David. No, my master said to me that Hashem, before whom I've walked, will send his angel with you, and he's going to make you successful, and you're going to find a wife for my son from there. And then you're going to fulfill your promise when you come to my family. And if v'im lo yitinu lach, and if they don't give her to you, then va'ita nakime alati, and then you'll be freed from your oath. So what is Eliezer doing over here? He forgot part of the story. What about the part where he said, well, can I bring Yitzchak back to live with your family?
If he says it, then they're going to be like, we'll bring him.
Well, because what did Abraham say to that?
Well,
he said, don't let that happen, right? So what is Eliezer? Eliezer's a smart guy. So he realizes that's not going to go over too well. So, right? So they'll say, well, we would really rather if Yitzchak moved here with us, because, you know, you guys like kind of live in the desert, wandering around. So you'll notice that there's another difference between Eliezer's words. It's a little more nuanced versus Abraham's words. Abraham said to Eliezer, don't take a wife for my son. Mi binota kena ani, asher anochi yoshev bekirbo, that I dwell in their midst. Okay? In their midst. But when Eliezer says it, he says, "Asher nochi yoshev be'artzo, in their land." Okay, that Avraham lives in their land. What's the difference?
But he's settled; he can't move.
It makes it sound like he's much more settled, doesn't it? Bekirbo means he's just hanging out in a commune with a bunch of people, and is like a hippie at Woodstock or something like that. He's amongst them, but he's not settled. Be'artzo means he lives in their land, meaning he's settled in their land. So Eliezer is trying to avoid them raising the question, why doesn't Yitzchak come live with us? We're settled here, we have homes here, we have property. Avraham is Bikir Bo. If he's just wandering around amongst these Kena'anim, why does he like that lifestyle better? Let him come back home. Why does he want to wander around like that? So he uses the term Be'artzo when he talks to them. He says he lives in their land, meaning he's settled there. It's a Kanani land, but he lives there. He dwells there permanently. He's not just wandering. So that way, they're not going to say, well, it's much better to come home here. And he certainly isn't going to tell them, and I asked him, what if they say no, should I bring Yitzchak back here? And Avraham said, God forbid, don't you dare bring him back there. What do you think they're going to say if he says that?
Well, I was homeless.
Right, what are you saying? Trying to say about us? Oh, we're good enough to give you our daughter, but we're not good enough to come live in our neighborhood? What do you... Yeah, it's chutzpah. It's an insult. That's really rude. Okay, you can come all the way here to get our child, to marry them, but you're saying that we're not good enough for you. God forbid that you would ever let my son go back to that place. What kind of way is talking about your in-laws is that? People say things about their in-laws, but not to their face. You know, you can't say that. So Eliezer is very wise in his presentation here. He realizes exactly what the parents of this girl are going to think. This guy has no money, number one. So the first thing that they say is, first thing Eliezer says is, he's got a ton of money. His father has a ton of money and he's giving it all to him. He doesn't get into this whole thing about God's, but you know, Hashem, the God of heaven, the God of earth. Hashem brought Avraham out of Ur HaKasdim. All of that is going to be like, what, he's better than us? What, he's superior to us? No, but God has blessed him, and in her old age, she had this miracle baby, Yitzchak, and all that, and look how blessed he is, and look at all, your daughter's going to get to have that. She's going to get to be part of this royal family. What a great deal. And we're not putting you down. God forbid that we're saying, I'm not going to tell you that Abraham told me that never let my son set foot in his in-law's neighborhood as long as he lives. I'm not going to tell them that because they're going to be insulted. I don't want to make it seem that they're inferior. I just want to make it seem that Abraham has a lot going on and it would be amazing to be able to go. That's the way you sell. You don't sell something good by telling people that what they have is bad or making them feel bad or inferior about what they have. You don't want to do that because people can become defensive, right? People start saying, what are you talking about? I have a, you know, people, let's say they live in a bad neighborhood. So you'll say, well, you know, let's say the daughter is going to marry a guy and he's going to move to a very nice neighborhood. So you don't want to put them down for what they have. They'll become defensive. What do you mean? I lived here my whole life. It's a beautiful neighborhood. We're very happy here and we love the roaches and, you know, we're all 18 of us are happy in the studio apartment. I don't know what you're talking about, you know, like it used to be like when the people first came here. So that's what it used to be. So the point is he doesn't want to put them down. He doesn't want to make them defensive. He doesn't want to make them feel that Avram is some elitist that thinks that they're not good enough. He wants to just play up the aspect that Avraham is, number one, very successful and worthy of hanging out with and connecting to. And number two, that Hashem is going to bless him. That Avraham is so sure. When I said to him, what if she doesn't want to come? He said, no, Hashem is going to bring you to the right place. So that's he's putting everything in the positive for them. And that's the beauty of Eli. It just shows you that when you're presenting something to somebody, how much you have to think, what is their psychological, what is their dog in the fight? You know, what is their, how are they going to relate to the situation? How are they emotionally going to respond to it? What are they going to get defensive about? What's going to turn them off? What's going to get them interested? The way that Abraham presents it to Eliezer, who's on the same page as he is and understands what Avram is about and why he can't let Yitzchak reverse everything that he's done and go back to Ur Kasdim and lose the whole uniqueness of the whole movement that he created. He can't do that. But they're not going to understand that. So he has to say to them that he's doing it for practical reasons. In other words, he has to put it in a framework and a way of understanding that they're going to be able to appreciate. Not, I'm better than you, not you're inferior, not you're a bunch of pagans, I don't want anything to do with you. They're not going to get that. Okay, just that Avram is very situated and settled where he is and he's extremely successful and we don't want to mess that up. Why would you want to mess that up? And that's so it just gives you a very, very useful practical insight when you're dealing with people and you want to persuade them or you want to get them on board with something. Let's say there's a project going on. Let's say there's a program going on and it has a religious element to it and it has a social element to it and it has many elements to it. So you want to get different members of the community involved. You don't go, a person who's more, you know, more secular, you don't try to sell them on the religious part of it. They're not going to care about that as much. Right? So you have to talk to them about the social aspect of it or maybe about, you know, if there's a business element to it or financial benefit, then you talk to them in those terms. Okay? So like a person, let's say they want to study, if they want to make the mistake of studying to be a rabbi, that's a mistake. But let's say they want to do that. So they go to their parents and they say, they want to become a rabbi because it's a very good career choice. Now they'd be lying, obviously. It's a terrible career choice. But the parents don't know. They think that he's going to be a janitor and it's certainly better to be a rabbi than a janitor most of the time. Right? So therefore, the idea is when you sell it, you could go to someone who appreciates Torah, they appreciate spirituality, they appreciate the community, and you tell them that you want to become a rabbi, they say, wow, that's wonderful. But if you go to your parents who want you to make a decent living and they say you're crazy. Unless you can show them that it's really an opportunity that's going to be lucrative and successful. Right? So you have to present things and package things for people in a way that speaks to their needs and where they're coming from and doesn't trample on anything. Like, for example, if you go to somebody who's not observant and say, this program is great, it's going to make people very religiously observant. They're going to say, well, I don't want that. What are you talking? Then, okay, forget it then. I don't want that. So you don't focus on the elements of something. Everything is multifaceted. You don't have to focus on every facet of something for every person. People relate to it differently. So you present it to them in the light that they're going to see the beauty of it. They're going to see the good of it. Most things have multiple benefits, not just one. So, and that's what you see from Eliezer. Eliezer is very wise in the way he presents the program, the proposition to his, Lavan and Bituel. Now, I'll just end with what we alluded to before about the question about why Eliezer's name is not mentioned. Okay, so you'll see that when he says to Lavan and Bituel, he's recounting to them exactly what happened with Abraham, and he said to Abraham, "Ulai lo telecha isha acharai." Maybe the woman is not going to come with me. Ulai. But if you look at the lettering of the words, ulai is spelled aleph lamed yud. Not aleph vav lamed yud. Not ulai, but elai. Elai means to me. Ulai means maybe. So with the vowels in Hebrew, you know, you could put the vowels underneath and you won't see them in the Torah. So you could spell something aleph lamed yud, and it could be elai, alai, ulai, Eli, which isn't a word, but you could put the vowels however you want. You don't see the vowels in the Torah. They're hidden. So it's spelled in a way that it could be read Eli. So what does Rashi say? Eli ketiv. Bata italo le Eliezer, vaya mechazel imto ilashi omalo Avraham, lifnot elav las yobito. That he's quoting the Midrash that says that Eliezer was really hoping that the mission would fail. Why? Because then he could go back to Abraham and say, the only choice you have is my daughter now. Right? You have to, Yitzchak has to marry my daughter. Now we get to be, you know, in-laws. Whatever you call that. Right? So he says, now it can be family. Because all this time, Eliezer's been the trusty servant of Abraham. For decades he's been working with him. He's been learning from him. He's been helping him teach. He helped him fight. He went out to war with him to fight against those kings. He's done everything for Abraham. And then at the end of the day, when it comes to marrying off children, and Yitzchak is getting older and, you know, getting ready to be married, and Eliezer's daughter is getting ready to be married, and Abraham says, God forbid that I would ever marry her to you. No way. She's going to be married into your family. So Eliezer says, well, what are you talking about? You know? So he's thinking, well, that might be true now, but if he fails in getting him married off to somebody from his family, he's going to have no choice. Eli, but it's going to have to come to me. Because he's not going to want to marry him off to one of the women of Canaan, of course, because they're really corrupt. He's not going to succeed. If he doesn't succeed with marrying Yitzchak off to somebody from his own family, he's going to have no choice but the bidi'avad, you know, the bottom of the barrel is me then. It's going to have to be my daughter. So Eliezer says, this is my only chance to be able to get married into the royal family here. Is if this mission fails. Deep down in the bottom, you know, deep down he was hoping he might have a chance to shine here. And so that's part of it. I think that might be the reason why his name isn't mentioned. Because the idea is that Eliezer here had to really put aside his own ambition. He had a motive to want the mission to fail. And that's why you see that Abraham... How can you tell that Abraham knew that Eliezer had his own ulterior motives, possibly?
He makes him swear.
You don't make your friend swear. Why would you make your trusty servant swear to do something? You don't trust him? You don't believe he's going to do it? Maybe Eliezer was thinking, you know, Abraham is not going to be around forever. Maybe he's going to pass away, and then, you know, I'll be in charge, and I'll say, okay, Yitzchak, you marry whoever I say. So Avram makes him swear. Why does he make him swear? Because he obviously realizes he has ulterior motives here. Possibly. He didn't act on them. But the point is, sometimes we go into a situation where we're kind of hoping maybe something won't work out, or maybe we're kind of hoping something will get canceled, you know? Or maybe we're kind of hoping something will happen that isn't supposed to happen for the good, for the bad, whatever it is. We have our own deep, you know, consciously or unconsciously, we have our own stake in what's going on, what we want to see happen. And so Eliezer going may have had, and that's what Rashi is pointing out here when he says ulai, but it's written elai, maybe even not consciously, but deep down was kind of hoping, maybe they were going to say, you know what, forget it, the deal is off, we don't want to do it. And then he could say, you know, Baruch Hashem, now I get to go back and say, sorry, Abraham, it didn't work out, look, you only have my daughter now. So the fact that the Torah is mentioning as alluding to that to show you that Eliezer had his own ulterior motives, he had his own agenda potentially, he didn't allow it to interfere with carrying out the task that he had. He didn't allow it to. Okay? So because of that, his name is taken out. In other words, he didn't allow his personal identity, his personal ambition to get involved. So the Torah takes his name out and just calls him the servant of Abraham. He was just the man, the servant of Abraham. Whatever personal, individual desires, interest, ambition, hopes, dreams, wishes he had, he put them aside. He just became Eved Abraham. He just did what Abraham wanted. It's like, you know, it's like when we oftentimes read these stories about these, you know, terrorists, and they bring them to these, like, Israeli hospitals, right? And you're thinking to yourself, how does a doctor, Israeli doctor, stand over this terrorist and have to take care of them and make sure they don't die and go to heroic measures to keep this person alive who just tried to kill, let's say, dozens of Jews? How do they do it? Because in that moment, as a doctor has to just be a doctor. Like, that's part of the Hippocratic Oath, basically. It's a very principled thing. You could see somebody come in and it's the most evil, horrible person, but your sense of principle is, I'm not a Jew, I'm not a person with my own feelings or thoughts about this individual. Let's say a Ku Klux Klan person, a neo-Nazi comes in. You can't allow your personal inclinations, desires, or thoughts, or ambitions, or whatever it is, to come into play. You purely have to look at the person as a patient. Okay? And it's very hard to do. I'm sure it's very challenging for them to do. That's why, you know, they would never let's say, a relative perform surgery on another relative. Because they know it's too close to home. It's too emotional. You could see a mohel who might be able to do brit milah for many babies, but on their own baby, they get nervous. Because it's much more, it's closer to home. So this is the idea, this is the, you know, the idea in Eliezer, that Eliezer may have had his own ambitions and hopes for all the time he invested in Abraham all these years, hoping that somehow he would get a part of that legacy. And even so, even though deep down he was kind of hoping that it might fall out in his favor, he might win the lottery, he didn't allow that to derail his mission, to take over his mission. He stayed true to the mission. And it's so important for us to always put, you know, Hashem first, put what's right for our community first, what's right for the Jewish people first, even when it might seem to run afoul of our own hopes and dreams and personal aspirations. Sometimes we have to put those aside for the greater good or for a higher purpose, like Eliezer did. And, you know, that's the greatest zechut of all, to be able to accomplish that and achieve that. And it's amazing that we learned that from Eliezer, because it says that, it says that there are many parashiyot in the Torah, many mitzvot in the Torah, that we learn from one word, or from one letter. We learn many halachot from one letter in the Torah. But Eliezer's speech about how he found Rivka is repeated twice, word for word, the entire speech, twice. Right, first it describes it, and then he tells over the entire story again, because the Sichat Chulin of the Avdei Avot, it says that the talk, the chatter of the servants of Avraham Avinu is worth more than the mitzvot of the banim, than the commandments that were given to the children of Avraham Avinu. Meaning, you can learn so much from the character of somebody like Eliezer, even more sometimes than you can learn from a halacha. A halacha is just a little fragment; it's just a little piece of a detail of a law that we have to keep. But to see a person like Eliezer in action, how he lived and how he made choices and how wise he was in dealing with the parents of Rivka and how he was able to overcome his own ambition to do it, you learn like volumes and volumes from that, much more even than you could learn from a single halakha. And that's why the Torah places so much emphasis on. That's a beautiful thing.